John Munson in for the vacationing Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The 1960s, a decade that started with great hope and ended in protest and violence, a turbulent decade, one that reshaped America, presaging the political divide that has become ever wider since. In his book, The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America, historian James Patterson points to 1965 as the pivotal year in American history and shows how this one year in the middle of the decade set the stage for everything that came after. James T. Patterson is a Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University and author of a number of books, including Restless Giant, The United States from Watergate to Bush v. Gore, Brown versus the Board of Education, and Grand Expectations, The United States, 1945 to 1974, which won a Bancroft Prize. Professor Patterson, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show. The 60s seemed like it was more than just 10 years, and historians have actually used the term the long 60s. What do we mean by that?
Just pretty much what they say. People who argue this, and I sort of agree with it, would maybe make it as go as long as 1960 or 1959 to 1973 or 74. That's when we finally got out of the Vietnam War. So it's also about 1973 or 4 is when the economy started to go south, and the later 70s were a lot different from the late 60s in that sense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you can see the 60s is going for a 12 or 15-year period. My book, of course, argues that what we really think of as the 60s, you know, a time of a lot of anti-war protest and increasing violence in the cities and political polarization, so forth and so on, doesn't really pick up strongly until 1964, 65.
Well, for those like myself who came of age in the 1960s, it was a time of tremendous change. There were momentous events that took place all during that decade, and you could pick out, a number of years of the decade and point to one or more transformative things that happened. So 1965, what is it about that year that made it your focus?
I think two things really set the stage for the later, much more turbulent 60s. The first is increasing troubles in the civil rights movement. We know about Selma. And, of course, the Watts riot later in the year. It's a time when the movement begins to break up, when the allegiance to nonviolence is tested, when interracial cooperation, with some exceptions, tends to fall apart. And, of course, later in the 60s, starting with Watts, we have a whole range of riots. The other thing, of course, is Vietnam. And Johnson, who had said that during the campaign of 64, running against Goldwater, who was Barry Goldwater, who was a hawk for the Republican Party. Johnson is a Democrat. He didn't run as a peace candidate, but he certainly tried to persuade the public that he was not a warmonger and that we were not going to go in Vietnam, and actually said so in a famous statement in October, just before the election. But in early February, we start bombing around the clock. And on March 6th or 7th, pretty much the same day as Selma, we send in our first ground troops, combat troops. And at the start of the year, we only had 23,000 so-called military advisors in Vietnam. By the end of the year, we had 184,000. By the end of 1966, we had 400,000 and so forth. So it's really the war and civil rights activity that sets in motion so many things in the later 60s.
Well, you mentioned the Johnson quote during the campaign, and I've got that here. He said, "We are not about to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles away from home to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves." But, you know, he said that. But hadn't the decision pretty much already been made not to lose South Vietnam to the communists, no matter what the cost?
Yes, he wasn't telling the truth. 3 days after Kennedy's assassination in November 63, Johnson met with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was our ambassador to Vietnam, and he said, I'm not going to be the president to lose Vietnam. He remembered vividly having been a senator from Texas starting in 1949, all of the trouble that the Democratic president of that day, Harry Truman, had when he was accused of, quote, losing China to the communists. And that was a greatly exaggerated charge, to put it mildly, but it politically was fairly successful and put Truman on the defensive, and Johnson didn't want that to happen to him. And he really did believe that there was a Cold War after all, that we had an obligation. He claimed that Kennedy had said so, Eisenhower had said so, Truman had said so, and in differing ways they had, but they'd never said that they were necessarily going to send in ground troops. But Johnson, whenever he spoke on the subject, and he tried to do it as little as possible to keep it under the table in 1965 and thereafter, would say he was just carrying out the policies of his predecessors.
Yeah, he was very conflicted about the situation in Southeast Asia. I mean, he didn't want to be, as you pointed out, he didn't want to be remembered as the president who lost South Vietnam. But he also said there's really nothing over there worth fighting for. And
That's
he
right.
did not want to be there.
That's right. And he knew, by the way, if he did go in, that it was going to be a long, hard slog. Some people think that Johnson were, I don't think too many serious historians think that anymore, but at the time, a lot of people thought Johnson just sort of waded clumsily and blindly into a quagmire, as the phrase was. Well, no, he knew very well this was going to be a long, tough struggle. And when he went in, he knew he was in for a long struggle. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that he wanted to keep it quiet as long as he could once he sent in the troops. And we didn't hear much about it, what was going on in there in 65, and how many troops were there, and how bad the bombing was, and so forth. Because he had a great society program. He wanted to get through Congress in 65, and he didn't want to have everybody on his back over Vietnam.
Well, and there's so much to talk about. I don't want to get into a talk show quagmire in Vietnam, but it certainly was one of the key themes, not just of 1965, but of much of the 1960s. Let's talk about some of the other broad themes of this period. You mentioned civil rights as one of them, the war in Vietnam. There were a number of other themes from that period that were really important to our understanding of that decade. Johnson had his great society platform that he was trying to push. Let's try and capture an overview of what were some of the major ideas that were floating around at that time.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. Johnson had proclaimed the Great Society in 1964, but that was sort of a holding year. He had a presidential election to win, which he did win with a huge margin, and it brought enormous Democratic majorities to both houses of Congress. They hadn't been that large since the 30s. They haven't been that large since. And this was a big advantage to him. And he set to work a number of study groups to study the major problems that he wanted to deal with. One was health care, and he had in mind what became Medicare and Medicaid. That was passed in 1965 and was going through Congress in early 65 laboriously at the same time that the other things I mentioned were going on, including the war. He also pushed for and received an Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which set aside $2 billion initially. The first time in American history, really, that the federal government, as opposed to the states and the localities, had provided large sums of money to public schools in the United States. And this was really a part of his larger war on poverty, which he was also defending. This was passed in late 64 and had its funding greatly increased in 1965. He also wanted to reform our immigration system, which was very racist and restrictionist at that time, going back to the 1920s. He also succeeded in getting that done. He wanted to get the government involved in the arts and the humanities, and this was the beginning in 1965 of the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. There was some legislation passed for clean air and clean water. Money was set aside for what became HUD, the new cabinet agency, Housing and Urban Development. I mean, I could go on and on. It was an amazingly ambitious liberal program, and almost all of it was passed. And Johnson was really anxious to get this done in early 65 before he got into deep trouble over Vietnam, and he just barely did.
Well, he clearly, of the presidents, Johnson seems to have been the one that understood how Congress worked better than probably any other. I think there's an argument to be made there. I was particularly struck by, you pointed out, his views on how important it was to get things done in the first year of any presidential term.
Yes.
There's a quote. He says, you've got just 1 year when they treat you right and before they start worrying about themselves. And I thought that was particularly telling. Members of Congress have to run for re-election more often, well, at least in the House, more often than the president does. You maybe got a year before they start running for re-election again, and then it's every man for himself.
Yes, and in fact, if you look back at American history, that's generally been true. Woodrow Wilson, for instance, got through a fair amount of Democratic legislation, the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Trade Commission, and so forth, a lower tariff in 1913-14. Roosevelt, of course, got a lot through in 1933 and again in 35. And Johnson was well aware that presidents have a very short window to get big, ambitious programs through.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the book, The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America, with its author, historian James T. Patterson. You can join us as well at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Maybe you were on a university campus or you had maybe you were down south working on civil rights. What were you doing in 1965? And maybe you can share your recollections of that period with us as well at 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is our email address, and you can find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter and join us that way as well. 800-486-8655. As I said, James Patterson is my guest. He's the author of The Eve of Destruction. We're focusing on 1965 as a seminal year in U.S. history. Professor, the economy was booming at the beginning of 1965. I mean, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up an astonishing amount that it would set a record at that time, which would be considered paltry by today's standards. But it crossed the 900-point threshold sometime during the year. Major news outlets seemed to be competing with one another to see who could use the most expansive language to talk about the rosy economic future for the United States. Was there really good reason for as much optimism as we see at the beginning of that year?
Well, as you say, excuse me, the economy was, as you say, really booming. Had been since 1961, and the 60s, in fact, were the longest period of uninterrupted economic growth in modern American history. People tend to forget that, and one of the results of that very low employment, very low inflation, only very small deficits early in the 60s in the government finances, was greatly expanding expectations. This is the title of one of a book that I wrote once, but it wasn't new to the 60s, but they really, really boomed then. And when you have a lot of expectations, of course, you tend to be rather more militant and rather more demanding and rather slow to accept rejection. And all of these things were true, for instance, of the civil rights movement and of other movements for rights and various benefits that the government could give them. So Johnson was very fortunate in being president with these enormous Democratic majorities in an economy so he didn't have to worry about, you know, dealing with an economy or depression or taxes or anything like that. And he pushed through this enormously ambitious program of Great Society legislation, which we hadn't seen anything like since the 30s, and have seen nothing like since.
800-486-8655, the number to call to join our discussion this hour. We're talking about the book, The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. James Patterson is the author of that book, and he is my guest this hour. Again, 800-486-8655. We're going to pause, and when we come back, I have a really interesting statistic from a public opinion survey taken in 1965 that I think will be surprising. I know it was surprising to me reading it a number of years after the fact, but it kind of surprised me. It may surprise you as well. We'll talk about that when we return. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on The Kathleen Dunn Show. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the book, The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America, written by James Patterson. And wondering what you have to say about that particular year or about the decade of the 60s at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you don't call, I have 4 pages of my own questions, which I will ask. We'll never get to all of them. One of the things that, I don't know, it struck me because we've had so many years of thinking exactly the opposite from this, but this may have been one of the reasons why President Johnson was initially as successful as he was, is that in 1965, people believed that a vast majority of people believed that government could do good things. There was a poll that was conducted that found that 75% believed that they could trust the government to do the right thing most of the time. That just really is astonishing, considering that today it's probably close to the opposite. What was it that gave people so much more trust in the government than they have today, do you think?
Why did they have more then than now?
Yeah.
Well, partly because, as I said before, the economy was so strong since 1961, and while not very many people gave government credit for all of that, the mood was generally, outside of the very crucial exception of civil rights, where things had been heating up, the mood generally was very optimistic about the future and about the government's ability to get this done. And both Kennedy and Johnson, of course, had made a lot of speeches. Kennedy's rhetoric, we all remember, and Johnson's as well in the Great Society. Grand visions, and people bought into these. It was a time when people really believed that you could fine-tune things with government and make things better.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the culture of 1965 as being rules-based rather than rights-based. What do you mean by that?
I think it was, in many ways, the early 60s. We're like the 50s, in a sense, when people... They had expectations, but they hadn't really become grandiose like they became under Johnson and later. People lived according to kind of rules, you could call them, or standards of conduct in their daily lives and in their interactions with other people. Again, race is a huge exception, the way we treated blacks. But the sense that people had a whole lot of rights, and the government must defend these, was one major result of the civil rights movement, which was intensifying in that time. And the rights consciousness that the blacks were championing, of course, later moved on behalf of the disabled, non-English speakers, women, gays, and so forth and so on. And we've been living with this rights consciousness ever since, which is so much stronger than it had been before that.
There was one thing. I mean, it's been a long time ago, and a lot of those images are still familiar to many of us, but you saw there were pictures of people going to protest, men wearing ties and women wearing skirts and sweaters. You know, that just later in the 60s, of course, we didn't see that. Was there just kind of a shift at some point here, 1965, say, where we went from even in our protests, we were perhaps more orderly or certainly better dressed. And then all of a sudden it was a different atmosphere. What changed there?
Yes, you know the 60s, are, and you've read my book carefully. That's amazing. Excuse me. That's amazing. If you look at pictures, as you've done, photographs of, let's say, the students protesting in the free speech movement at Berkeley in 1964, December. This was the first major, by the way, college protest. And people just had not expected anything like that to happen. Time magazine ran a big special issue, in fact, in February 1965, in which they basically said that the old struggles between the generations seemed to have disappeared. And so Mario Savio, in the one of the leaders of the free speech movement in Berkeley, if you look at his pictures, he's wearing a coat and tie, very few beards. The students, as you say, were wearing chinos, the women wearing dresses and socks, very few beards, no afros. The Students for Democratic Society claimed only 1,365 paid-up members at the time of their national convention in December 1964. All the things that we associate with this, a lot of the things we associate with the 60s, particularly on the campuses and among students in dress and behavior and hairstyles and so forth, they just changed dramatically in 1965 and 1966. In fact, you can talk to people, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who, let's say, graduated from college in 1964 and would have a younger sister or brother who would graduate in 66 or 67. They didn't understand each other. It was a whole different world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know I wasn't allowed to wear jeans to school until I went to college, so that shows you how I was raised. Let's take some phone calls. A lot of people want to get in on this, as I expected. Let's go to Michael in Cloquet, Minnesota. Michael, good afternoon. Thanks for being here today.
Good afternoon. I appreciate your program. The 60s, to me, brings back memories of the counterculture, the hippies, the hippie movement, the burning the draft cards. I was a hippie until Kent State, when the National Guard killed those students, and I became very angry and radical. And in fact, I still am. I still remember that like it happened yesterday. And appreciate you taking my call, and thanks.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insights. Professor, there were a lot of people who may not have been very radical, but suddenly became radical because of events that they witnessed.
Yes, a lot of people became radical, but a far larger number of people became anti-war. And it's not necessarily the same thing. Virtually all of the radicals were anti-war, but not all of the anti-war people were radicals, if this makes any sense. I'd say that many of the radicals had a fairly clearly thought-out notion of how the world ought to work and had read things and discussed things and so forth. The SDS believed in participatory democracy, and the civil rights groups, of course, had a lot of meetings. And these people definitely were different from the hippies were a small number. But a lot of the others were quite different from what we'd seen in the 50s.
A lot of people don't remember that LSD, for example, was legal in California until 1966.
Yes.
That always just fascinated me. Well, of course, at one time cocaine was legal, but that was a long time ago. Let's take another call. Charlie in Milwaukee is with us today. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. The question I have regarding, I think you're talking about the divide between that occurred around 1965 and the hippies and stuff like that, is we have to remember that in the 50s and 60s, there was a beatnik generation, that there was marijuana and drugs, and there was a counterculture, so to speak, with the hair and the beards and the what have you, that existed, but it wasn't very prominent. And I was just wondering if your guest could comment on the use of, say, music, the music that exploded in the 60s, as well as the increased wealth to buy the records and to buy the music that allowed for the counterculture to become more prevalent.
Charlie, thanks so much for the call. Professor?
That's a good question, because the book that we're discussing, my book, is called The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. And The Eve of Destruction, as you probably know, because you just mentioned the music, was perhaps the first really large-selling popular song. It went to the top of the hit parade in September 1965, and it's a loud and strongly anti-war and anti-racism and anti-nuclear weapons verses. And it remained a popular tune throughout late 65. It was also the year when the Rolling Stones came out with I Can't Get No Satisfaction, which again was a much more popular hit, and took aim at a whole range of topics which greatly attracted people. It is in 1965, really, that you begin to see this strong turn of popular music towards louder and more angry and more political and more topical kinds of songs. You still had, of course, the others, but you hadn't had outside of the folk singers like Dylan and others, and that's a different genre, much of that until 1965.
Yeah, and it wasn't long after that you had Creedence Clearwater Revival with "Fortunate Son," and that was a song about the Vietnam War. You started to get a lot of protest music, but I remember hearing Barry McGuire's "Eve of Destruction" on the radio a lot in 1965. It was a huge hit.
Some stations refused to play it.
Well, yeah, that's true, and we kind of forget about that as well. That did happen, and that brings up another question, though. Okay, so we had the anti-war movement, but there was a little bit of a backlash against that as well. And when I look at this, and especially in the context of your book, Professor Patterson, it seems to me that some of the seeds for this. You could actually look at, for example, Ronald Reagan's speech at the 1964 Republican National Convention. He spoke on behalf of Barry Goldwater, and his speech certainly electrified conservatives, launched him into the national spotlight as something other than a B-movie actor. But is it fair to say that that kind of that may have been kind of a seminal moment for the revival of conservative politics in the United States?
Yes, everybody thought that after Goldwater got absolutely massacred at the polls, the only states he carried were five deep South states and his home state of Arizona. And Johnson got about 61% of the vote. It's the most any president in modern times had received. And there were columns by well-known columnists late 64, early 65, wondering if the Republican Party would survive. But they got their act together and pushed Goldwater's strongly conservative view somewhat to the side. And then, of course, Reagan was an immensely popular person, who as early as November and December of 65 was very much in public view, giving speeches. And then he ran for the governor of California in 66 and beat a two-term, eight-year Democratic governor in the state of California, and he was off and running after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the conservatives bounced back, and so you have the conservatives revival, and you have the liberals on the defensive, and you get a lot of political polarization, and the mood of let's get things done and we can do it rapidly diminishes.
Well, the campaign in 64, and I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but the campaign in 1964 was pretty negative. I mean, you talk about it as being more negative than any other post-World War II campaign to that date. Certainly since then, we've seen, I think, more negative campaigning. But what was it about this campaign that made it so negative? How did that become a thing?
I couldn't really tell you that. Goldwater was a very polarizing, very unusual candidate because, as you know, usually a candidate, if he or she expects to win a national election, has to, and usually does, move toward the center so that his or her true loyalists won't be the only ones supporting him. And Goldwater would have none of that. He was a really terrible political candidate from the standpoint of hoping to win, and from the standpoint of hoping that his message would catch on. And Johnson was a tough fighter in campaigns. He got always totally wound up and worn out, and usually had had to recover physically from these because he was so energetic. And most people remember his famous Daisy speech, where he goes on the air and one after another plucks petals off a daisy as if counting down to Armageddon, when the whole world would be destroyed by people like Goldwater who wanted to drop atomic bombs on the Soviet Union. So Johnson was probably worse than Goldwater. But yes, it was by views, according to views of most people at the time, it was the most the angriest and most polarizing campaign in a long time.
Let's take a phone call from Jim in Rice Lake next. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Professor. I'm enjoying your show. I just wanted to mention to Professor a brilliant book, Richard Perlstein's Nixon Land, he documented that Johnson ran to the right of Goldwater in Vietnam in '64, which it was contrary to the progressive tradition in the civil rights movement, which led to higher black expectations, which led to protests, which ultimately led to the Nixon Counter-Reformation. And Perlstein analyzed between '64 and '68. From Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society to Richard Nixon in '68, we went through 20 years of change in four. I'll take my comments and answers off the air.
Yeah, I had a little time trouble understanding all you said, but you were saying that it was a very, very, very polarizing campaign.
Well, yeah, and that because of the way Johnson campaigned, certain expectations were raised, and then we had kind of a counter-reformation or revolution with Nixon in '68 and kind of went the other direction.
Yes, yes. It's an amazing turnaround. I mean, you go from Johnson winning 61% of the vote in 1964 to Hubert Humphrey getting something like 40% in 1968, and Nixon and Wallace, the other two candidates, winning, almost 60% of the vote compared to Johnson having done it 2 years before. This was an enormous turnaround.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more with James Patterson, author of The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. Phone lines are full. If you get a busy signal, send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or join us on Facebook or Twitter. Look for The Kathleen Dunn Show and contribute to the discussion that way. 800-486-8655. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment as our discussion continues. Kathleen Dunn's on vacation. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, tomorrow afternoon on The Kathleen Dunn Show at 2 o'clock, we'll talk about numbers and the origins of numbers because, well, virtually everything in our lives is digital. We're all controlled by ones and zeros. But where did we get numbers from anyway? We'll talk about that tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on The Kathleen Dunn Program. This hour, we're talking about 1965, and there's a new book out called The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America. James Patterson is the author of that book. He's a Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University and author of a number of other books as well. This just happens to be the one we're talking about today. We have more callers on the line who want to get in on this discussion. Let's go to the phones and talk to Lynn in Eau Claire next. Lynn, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good afternoon. Fantastic subject. I'm soon to be 60. I remember the 60s. And what I remember specifically, and what it is my idea that where perceived trust in the government was at that time, we saw we saw the bodies on the news in Vietnam. We saw the flag-draped coffins. We saw Bobby Seals or court sketchings of him being shackled in court in the Chicago 7. And we saw the riots and the horrific toll on humanity in Selma and the like in the South. And it goes on and on and on, what we saw. And now it seems we don't see what's going on. And you don't know what you don't see, and you don't trust, because the bodies keep coming, but we don't see them.
Lynn, thanks so much for that call. Professor, let's talk about the role of the media as things changed in 1965. Lynn talks about seeing the flag-draped coffins. Certainly, media coverage of the war in Vietnam had a huge impact on how we felt about it. I know, what was it, Johnson, who said, once you've lost Walter Cronkite, you've lost the war, or something like that. I know he had some comment like that.
Yes, it's true, although I think maybe that can be exaggerated. I think until mid-66, public opinion polls still showed substantial in a range of 60% of Americans thinking Johnson had done a good job as president. And they were still supporting the war despite more than a year of fantastically increased escalation. And as I mentioned before, you do have a small radical contingent. The SDS greatly expands, but it becomes overwhelmingly an anti-war organization as opposed to a broadly left-wing organization. And the people who really had a radical view of what the world should be like were not large in the United States. So, and the media, yes. But the actual newscasts were very, very cautious, and insofar as they can be non-judgmental and not partisan. You didn't, of course, have all of these cable networks then. You just had the major networks. And Cronkite, in fact, was probably essentially pro-war, but he kept his opinions to himself. Until after the Tet Offensive in February of 1968, which is when he announced that, well, you know, we're not going to win this war, we're not winning it. And within a month, Johnson decides not to run again, and so forth and so on. So I'm not sure I would, you know, when they say it was the first living room war, I mean, you could see the war on television. You couldn't actually. There weren't people filming jungle combat. In Vietnam, you didn't see as nearly as much of the fighting as you would even today with all of our networks and all of our greatly increased communications. But yes, I mean, Johnson couldn't stop the reports of casualties, and all of his optimism, of course, came to seem completely dishonest by the time he left office in 1968. So the media mattered, but I'm not sure I would say they promoted a vast change in public opinion.
Well, Lynn, thanks for the call. Let's go to Anita in Gurnee, Illinois next. Anita, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for this program. I was wondering if your guests could comment or speculate on why it is I, like so many others, are disappointed. I'm in my 60s and remember the 60s very well. And a huge portion of the anti-war protest that was heard over and over was on the radio with the very often the war protest songs that the popular singers of the time were putting forth. And now in the last 10, 12 years, the only thing that I can remember hearing was a very moving and potent revival of Masters of War by Eddie Vedder. It's the only thing that I can remember hearing. So I'm wondering, does this have to do with these people being under contract and they're not allowed to do that kind of thing, or what? I can't get over the lackadaisical attitude.
Well, Anita, thanks so much for that call. A great question. We had a tremendous amount of protest music in the 60s, almost nothing today.
That's a good question. It really is, and I don't have an answer either because I don't know that much about the music business. There are, of course, a lot of anti-war statements being made by people in the music business and so forth. But as for anti-war music, you're right. You don't hear a lot of it.
Well, it's certainly one difference between the kind of war that we have now and the war in Vietnam was that the war in Vietnam, the military was populated by the draft, and now we've got an all-volunteer army, which seems to have changed the game in a number of ways. But that's probably the topic for an entirely different talk show.
And I should say one other thing. We lost 58,000 men in Vietnam. Our casualties now, again, if you're fighting over there, it's because you joined the services. So you're not being drafted. Your kids aren't being drafted. Your brother's not being drafted. They're not being killed in an insane war. So that's part of it. But as to why there aren't more anti-war songs, I don't have an answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly remember standing next to the UPI teletype machine in the campus radio station of the school where I was going as the draft lottery numbers were published, and being very thankful that my number was 226. I want to shift the focus a little bit because we spent a lot of time talking about the war in Vietnam. That certainly is a huge, huge piece of what happened in 1965. There were, you mentioned Selma. Bloody Sunday, March 7th, 1965. Remind us of what happened that day. And was that a tipping point, did you think, in the battle to pass an effective Voting Rights Act?
Yes, what happened on Bloody Sunday. It was March 7th, 1965. And the Martin Luther King's organization, along with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had been campaigning for voting rights in Selma, the SNCC people, for more than 2 years, King since the start of 1965. And there was a lot of violence in Selma against black nonviolent protesters, much of it shown on TV, even before Selma. But Selma was even before the Bloody Sunday. And this is when they tried to start a march to Montgomery, the state capital, to present a petition to the Governor Wallace, who was a racist, on behalf of voting rights, which almost no black people in the Deep South had because of the way they operated the registration system. They couldn't even register to vote. And when they got on the bridge, they were attacked by the local sheriff as well as Alabama troopers, and a lot of them were beaten up. John Lewis went to the hospital. He's now, and has been for a long time, a black congressman from Georgia. And This was all shown on TV over and over and over again. Johnson tried to keep it off the air, but you know, they kept showing it. And then there were more struggles after that at Selma. And I think it's true to say that without Bloody Sunday, and Johnson later on went on television and made the famous speech over television to both houses of Congress in a prime time speech a little bit 2 weeks later, and famously said, "And we shall, very slowly, we shall overcome." And most people agree that without Selma, without the violence being shown, the surge of public opinion on behalf of a strong Voting Rights Act might not have passed.
Mm-hmm. 800-48...
It did finally pass in August of 1965.
And that was certainly a bushel basket full of legislation that Johnson got passed that year. 800-486-8655. Let's go back to the phones and hear from Jim in Lake Geneva. Jim, hello.
Hello, how are you?
And great.
Great program. I heard the pain of the woman that was on earlier, and I feel the same pain. Having lived through that, I'm 78 years old. And I knew the 60s were longer than the 60s because I was in the Army in 58, I was drafted. But I was already in the Carpenters Union from 56 on. And I served from 58 to 64. And after Kennedy was assassinated, I just, the bottom fell out for me. And then I began to piece everything together, and it was just such a traumatic time. And when my wife and I were raising a family during the Vietnam War, I swore that if that kept going on, I would take them all to Canada. I would never again want anybody to see the damage of war. I have a bumper sticker that says, "War, what is it good for? You know, no more mm-hmm. war." Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the generation that we are. We still feel the pain of the time. And so maybe they can call it post-traumatic stress. But it shapes me today because I work for peace organizations, and I'm very active in that peace group.
Well, Jim, thanks for your call. And Professor, you know, the theme of your book seems to coincide a little bit, I think, or a lot with what Jim is saying. I mean, the what happened in 1965 still reverberates here in 2015.
That's my claim, yes. It is. By the way, the book's in paper.
It's in paperback. It's published by Basic Books.
Right.
John and Stevens Point. Jim, thanks for the call. John and Stevens Point, you'll be next. And John, go ahead. John, are you there? Okay, I think we lost John. Let's go to Morgan in Milwaukee. Morgan, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I see, you know, like our government, kind of like our parents, you know, as kids we know, we see slash sense something not right. But like parents, the government, they don't tell us the whole truth, but just enough to kind of keep us quiet, kind of like Lynn was saying before, like what we don't see and know, you know. And also, and two, on the music, because I'm 29, so music generation now, I think of the song that was coming to my head before right away was the John Mayer song, like We're Waiting for the World to Change. You know, he puts, like, not that we don't care. We just know the fight's not fair, so we keep on waiting. So, you know, there's some little things like that I noticed. And also then my question is like, you know, presidents, says like, for, you know, Johnson, for example, or even now, do they even really know the whole truth about, like, war or what they're getting into? They, you know, they walk around going, we don't want war. But then until, like, they're signed in, they sit down in that office, they find out the details and what's really going on. And also, too, like, my other question, too, what's, about that, kind of what also, you know, plays roles, like, what do they...
Okay, well, we're almost to the end of the program, so a lot to chew on there, Professor. But, you know, is it Johnson was kept out of the loop on a lot of things before the death of President Kennedy, and he was suddenly thrust into there. Was he, what surprises were waiting for him when he stepped into the Oval Office?
What surprises?
Yeah.
I don't think he was surprised by much of anything. He was really, he'd been in Washington since the early 1930s as a congressional aide, as a congressman, and as a senator, and as a majority leader, and a minority leader of the Senate and vice president. He was kept out of the loop by the Kennedy people, and he resented that. They didn't treat him very well. In fact, Bobby Kennedy hated him, and he hated Bobby Kennedy. But I don't think he stepped into the Oval Office and found something was happening he didn't know anything about. He certainly knew about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left, Professor. What's as we look back on 1965, what's the most important thing to remember about that period? And are there lessons that maybe we still haven't learned yet?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most important things that happened, we've talked about, of course, the breakup of the civil rights movement. The Watts riot was a terrific blow to in a lot of ways. We haven't had time to go into that. And, of course, the escalation to the Vietnam War, which started in 1965, and all the divisiveness after that. I'm not sure I can add much to that. It was a pivotal year, and it had long-range repercussions. 1968 is memorable for all kinds of horrible individual things happening. The Tet Offensive, the assassination of King, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the election of Richard Nixon, et cetera, the Democratic Convention of 1968. Mm-hmm. All of these things were, you know, world-shattering events. But 65 set this stuff in motion.
Well, I only got through 3 pages of my 4 pages of questions, Professor, but we're out of time, and I really appreciate you coming on the show with me today. It was very educational.
Well, you're well informed. Thank you for asking me.
The Eve of Destruction, How 1965 Transformed America, James T. Patterson, the author, published by Basic Books. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, who produced this hour of programming. And we had the exciting combo of Myers and Whaley producing on air this afternoon. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll let Barry McGuire take us home. We're on the eve of destruction here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me.